Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Wyatt Orme. Today we hear about the results from two Glenwood Springs City Council races.
Senator Cory Gardner will visit the Rifle Airport next week.
A controversial land exchange is made after nearly 10 years.
And we talk with three Aspen Winter Words authors about their debut books.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
In Glenwood Springs, this month's election results are in. 5,000 ballots were sent out. A little over 2,000 came back. The city will tax the pot industry and welcome three new council members. Wyatt reports.
Shelley Kaup won the at-large city council seat with 811 votes. Charlie Willman came in second with 724 votes. According to campaign finance reports, Willman led his competition in overall fundraising, although Kaup did raise the most money in the second most recent period. The Ward 5 winner is Jonathan Godis with 272 votes. Amber Wissing came in second with 124. Wissing led her competition in fundraising. The Ward 2 candidate, Rick Voorhees, ran unopposed. Glenwood voters were asked to decide on two new taxes on marijuana. Issue 1 passed with 60% of the vote. This one stated a 5% tax on recreational marijuana sold within the city limits. Voters also said yes on Issue 2, which is a 5% excise tax on the marijuana being transferred from cultivation and manufacturing facilities to retail stores within the city. Kaup, Godis, and Voorhees will be sworn in at the April 20th City Council meeting.
Next week, key players promoting public health in the Valley are convening to address funding for mental health services. Allison Bechtesh reports.
Many agencies have line items for mental health services in their budget, including Pitkin, Garfield, and Eagle counties, along with Aspen Valley and Valley View hospitals. These organizations are now coming together for a two-day strategy session to see if their separate funds can be combined to make a bigger impact. Mitzi Lettingham, Deputy Director of Pitkin County's Health and Human Services, hopes the combined efforts can address some regional shortfalls.
You know, there's just a variety of needs, and part of our job is just to try to be a little more strategic in the delivery of these services.
While the financial strategy session is closed to the public, there is an open kickoff event on April 10th. Andrew Romanoff, the president and CEO of Mental Health Colorado, is speaking at Colorado Mountain College in Aspen. The former state legislator will be talking about measures at the Capitol that address mental health and substance abuse programs. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
Last week, the Bureau of Land Management completed a long-debated land exchange with the billionaire Wexner family. The federal agency traded nearly 1,500 acres of land near the base of Mount Sopris for two properties totaling 670 acres of once private land that is close to popular recreation areas in Carbondale. Elizabeth has been following the development and spoke with producer Kristen Kay about the deal.
Elizabeth, give us some background. What land was exchanged?
The billionaires Leslie and Abigail Wexner, who own the parent company of Victoria's Secret and some other chain stores, have a 4,000-acre ranch at the base of Mount Sopris. But there's a big chunk in the middle of their ranch, about 1,300 acres, that was owned by the BLM. At the same time, the nonprofit conservation organization in the valley, the Aspen Valley Land Trust, had been trying to conserve a ranch adjacent to Red Hill up in Missouri Heights that's called Schutte Ranch. And that ranch is important elk habitat in the middle of a lot of development up on Missouri Heights that AVLT thinks is a key place to preserve, but they hadn't been able to make it happen. So the Wexners wound up buying Schutte Ranch about a decade ago with the purpose essentially of trading it to the BLM for that piece of federal property in the middle of their ranch. So the Wexners initiated the exchange, and they also bought land near Prince Creek where the trails up to Crown Mountain start, which mountain bikers already use even though it had been private land.
So the Wexners got more than double the amount of land that the public did. Why is there such a big discrepancy in the amount of land?
So these decisions in land exchanges are based on value, not on acreage. So the BLM believe it's a good trade, not because of the amount of land or the acreage, but because of where it's located. The land that the BLM used to own in the middle of the Wexner's ranch near the bottom of Mount Sopris was hard for the public to access. There weren't any roads going in there. So The appraisal showed that that land, the BLM land in the middle of the Wexner's ranch, was worth far less per acre.
So what's the disagreement? Why did this take over a decade to complete?
The BLM has to prove that any land exchanges are in the public interest, and there was a long public process. The BLM received about 270 comments, and two-thirds of those were in support. But there is also one-third that voiced opposition, and there was really strong opposition from a group called Colorado Wild and Public Lands. And they argue that the appraisals were not accurate, that actually that piece of BLM land that was in the middle of the Wexner's ranch should have been valued way higher than it actually was.
What's the benefit to the public in this case? What do people gain?
Well, they gain access to more recreation. So mountain bikers will no longer be trespassing when they ride that part of Prince Creek. And eventually there'll be more access and more places to play up on Red Hill.
To hear more details, go online to aspenpublicradio.org.
On Tuesday night, Aspen Words veterans Stephanie Danler, Anna Noyes, and Molly Prentice spoke about their debut book releases. Claire Woodcock spoke with the authors while they were in town.
Each of you were emerging writers through a fellowship with Aspen Words between 2014 and 2015. Tell me what that was like.
My name is Stephanie Danler, the author of Sweet Bitter. I had just graduated from my MFA program 2 weeks before. It was the first time I had seen my novel as a whole, and then to have feedback on it immediately, that's the kind of thing, like, I could have finished my novel and it could have sat in a drawer for 10 years, but Aspen kind of forced it into the light. The notes from that workshop are how I revised it, and I sold it later that year.
So a couple of years out of the Emerging Writers Fellowship, how does it feel to be back in Aspen actually speaking as experts on your debut novels?
Molly Prentice, I'm the author of Tuesday Nights in 1980. When you're writing, you're certainly having all of these reasons for what you're writing. It's coming out of your life. It's coming out of your mind, the way it works, the things you think about, the things you're obsessed with. But then when you have to retroactively address what you've written about, it becomes this different thing because people ask constantly, why did you choose to write about that? Or why is your character from Argentina? Or all these kinds of questions. And you have to be like, huh, why did I do that? But at the time, you were sort of just following your own whims. And to create the answers afterwards is this strange thing. It's almost like you're creating a story about the story. But it actually is really interesting to go back and address your own sort of thought process and your own obsessions, and then to like deliver that as sort of another layer.
What are some of the challenges that female writers publishing work for the first time have to go through?
My name is Anna Noyes, and I'm the author of the short story collection Good Night, Beautiful Women. All of us think we have these very serious literary books. I envisioned a cover that was like very dark and didn't have a cursive font on it. I love the way my book looks, but I also think that that is catering to a certain readership, that maybe I'll trick somebody into reading something that's darker and more serious than they wanted to get into when they picked up something that looks a little more lovely. It's a shift from how you perceive your work to how the world might, what kind of adjustments are made to make it more palatable.
That was Anna Noyes, Molly Prentice, and Stephanie Danler, three authors speaking with Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. To hear more of their conversation, as well as the authors reading excerpts from their recent publications, go to aspenpublicradio.org. This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. Stay in the know with what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and like us on Facebook for up-to-the-minute news updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
Beginner mountain bikers will soon have a new place to play, but first, the Roaring Fork Transportation Authority needs help building it, Elizabeth reports.
A new single-track trail will run between 8th Street and Highway 133 in Carbondale, with connections to the Rio Grande Trail. Brett Meredith, Trails Coordinator with RAFTA, says the topography will make for a fun trail for all ages.
We can kind of make it more playful and more of a flow type track. You know, it's a beginner mountain bike trail, so it's not super technical.
This will be part of a multi-use area, including three types of trails: the single track, the current asphalt, and an 8-foot-wide gravel walking path. But first, Rafta needs help finishing the surface. Volunteers are needed this Saturday from 8 to 4. Meredith says if all goes well, the trail will be open to the public immediately.
The Aspen City Council discussed building three new affordable apartment complexes during their work session this week. The conversation lasted 3 hours and touched on the differing interests involved. Allison Bektesh reports.
The developments are planned for city-owned land near the S-curves, the hospital, and the base of Smuggler. Those properties are not zoned for high-density residential, so must now go through the same zoning reviews that any private construction would have to go through. Jason Bradshaw is the project manager for the developer. He says they never thought it would be a speedy process.
As much as we want to deliver the housing, as much as the city wants to deliver the housing, the fact of the matter is that in Aspen, that takes some time.
Bradshaw and his team also presented public feedback gathered from open houses earlier this year. He says, as with any new construction he's worked on, the neighbors are the most vocal critics, but that the community as a whole supports new, high-density workforce housing within city limits. Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
Warmer temperatures mean the crews working on the Grand Avenue Bridge in Glenwood Springs are busier than ever. They're getting ready for the detour, where all traffic will be rerouted onto Midland Avenue later this summer. Wyatt took a walk with Tom Newland, who handles communications for the bridge project. He explains that it's long overdue.
You know, if you take a spoon and bend it and bend it and it finally breaks, well, that's kind of what's happening to the infrastructure of the bridge itself.
When was the existing bridge built?
In 1953.
What's it been like to work on?
Yeah, it's a big project. It's certainly the biggest project on the West Slope going on right now. It's right in the middle of Glenwood Springs, too, which makes it even more challenging.
Why do you say that?
Well, you're right in the heart of the town, so everything needs to be coordinated to accommodate for the massive amount of traffic that you have.
Do you have any sense for how massive it is? I mean, do you have any sense for how many cars cross the bridge every day?
Yeah, an average of 26,000 to 28,000 vehicles a day, and the way traffic's increasing will be over 30,000 soon.
What are kind of some of the biggest things you've accomplished, and then where do we have yet to go?
We're in phase three now, or just about in phase three, where we're getting ready to get everything ready for the detour. And that detour and bridge closure will happen on August 14th. We make the connection to downtown with the bridge portion we've already built, and then we open it back up to traffic in 95 days.
As far as public transportation goes, how's that going to work?
That's going good. The city is working with us to put in some additional crosstown shuttles that people can utilize, and Rafta is providing free service from Down Valley and the Hogback route up to Glenwood Springs.
Who's paying for all this?
Well, you're paying for it. Actually, CDOT has a fund that's known as the Bridge Enterprise Fund, which is specifically to repair bad bridges, comes out of your auto registration. However, we do have some local funding involved too. City of Glenwood Springs put in $3 million, as did Garfield County. Eagle County put in $100,000, and the Upper Valley governments are contributing to that free Rafta ride.
Has there been any kind of pushback from the kind of recreation side of things?
We did have some river closures last year during their peak season, and we're going to have to do that again in August, primarily to get that bridge across.
Tom Newland is the public information officer for the Grand Avenue Bridge. Thank you. Colorado Congressman Scott Tipton sits on two subcommittees that relate to public lands. He spoke with Elizabeth about proposed legislation and his philosophy on public lands.
During your telephone town hall, you spoke explicitly about protecting access to public lands, and certainly that access is important. I'm wondering, do you also see value in protecting the land itself?
Sure. You know, we've been on the record for being able to protect our public lands, and we'll continue to fight for that. And the access to them for our people to be able to get out and enjoy them. And we want to make sure that people can enjoy their public lands and keep them public.
There was a House rules package introduced very early in the session that effectively zeroed out the value of federal lands, a rule that critics say make it much easier to sell those public lands. Can you explain why you voted for that?
I didn't happen to support that individual amendment. However, the entire rules package is voted on in its entirety when it goes to the floor.
Sometimes if there's an amendment that you disagree with strongly enough, it would be enough to vote against the rules package as a whole.
Well, there are a variety of things in there that were important to our district in a number of different areas as well for the rules to be able to move Congress and to be able to get legislation to actually reach the floor.
There have been several bills introduced this legislative session that have local organizations and environmental groups concerned, and I have a couple questions from listeners and some questions about specific bills. So House Resolution 1349 would allow bicycles in all wilderness areas. Both the International Mountain Biking Association and our local chapter, the Roaring Fork Mountain Biking Association, have opposed similar efforts in the past. Opponents to bills like this say that allowing any mechanized travel in wilderness areas degrades the protections of those lands. How do you feel about mountain bikes in wilderness areas?
From what you're describing, that's something I think that, we need to work with the local communities on and make sure that it is designed as wilderness. And let's have that conversation within our local communities to see when and if it's appropriate. But generally, a lot of the bicycling groups that I have talked to, they feel comfortable with the trails that they have and the other access that they have on BLM Forest Service land.
Okay, thank you. House Resolution 622 terminates the Forest Service Law Enforcement Unit so that Forest Service employees would no longer police those federal lands. Our listener Brandon Jones asks, how would transferring Forest Service law enforcement to local sheriffs affect the White River National Forest?
Well, first of all, I don't think that all of our local sheriffs have the manpower or the resources to be able to accomplish that. And I've talked to a number of our local sheriffs. In many cases, they do happen to be the first responders, but they don't have the ability or, again, the resources to be able to go out, given the vastness of our public land, to be responsible for all of the law enforcement. And that's not something that I believe is viable.
Thank you. This question comes from our listener, Kirk Gregory. So as you know, the U.S. Forest Service is facing major budget shortfalls. And also last year, Congress adopted a bill that aims to increase trail maintenance by using volunteers. In Vail, citizens groups recently started a GoFundMe page for trail projects. And at the same time, fees collected from ski areas do not remain in the White River National Forest. Instead, they go into the federal treasury. Do you believe that that money should remain here in the White River National Forest for projects that are local?
You know, Elizabeth, I think that's something that we really do need to consider. In fact, I'd had the opportunity to just chair an oversight hearing in the Natural Resources Federal Lands Subcommittee, and we'd received testimony that is a viable option for us to look at in terms of being able to retain the user fees as they come into the national parks or into the Forest Service areas for use to be able to deal with a lot of the maintenance backlog that you're talking about.
Okay, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
That was Congressman Scott Tipton discussing issues related to public lands with Elizabeth. You can hear more of their conversation, including Tipton's approach to climate and energy issues, online at aspenpublicradio.org. You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orm. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday afternoon, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
Senator Cory Gardner will visit the Rifle Airport next Tuesday to learn about cutting-edge firefighting technologies. Wyatt has more.
According to his communications director, Senator Gardner wants to learn about the airport's aerial firefighting center. The Rifle Airport is home to a state program that researches things like nighttime firefighting and the use of drones. Garfield County Commissioner John Martin says Gardner's office reached out to initiate plans for the visit, which will also include a meeting with commissioners. This marks the beginning of Congress's April recess, which lasts 2 weeks. On April 21st, Senator Gardner will be the guest speaker at a fundraiser for the Garfield County Republicans in Glenwood Springs. During February's congressional recess, Gardner became the focus of national media attention for not attending town hall meetings he was invited to throughout the state, although he did hold telephone town halls. It is not clear if the senator will hold any town halls while in the area.
Colorado is now in its fourth year of legal recreational marijuana. Lawmakers spent the first couple years making changes to how the plant is grown and sold commercially, but now they're looking to crack down even further on homegrown cannabis. Correspondent Benta Berkland has more.
The major proposal would limit the number of plants grown for medical purposes at a residence from 99 to just 24. Republican Representative Cole Wist of Centennial says it would help law enforcement and prevent diversion to the black market.
Our liberal laws regarding plant count are being abused by folks that are seeking to ship marijuana outside the state.
Lawmakers are also concerned about public health risks, such as excessive power and electrical use that can pose fire hazards, noxious smells, mold, and water damage.
We had over 100 witnesses that came and testified, and I heard them loud and clear that they don't want us to criminalize medical treatment. And I completely agree with that.
To that end, Wist's bill would limit all plants grown at residences to 12. But a caregiver or someone on the medical marijuana registry could get double that amount. Democratic Representative Jonathan Singer of Longmont initially opposed the bill.
Most of our jurisdictions already have some sort of plant count limit. And so it's a little confusing to me why we would want to actually draw more attention to this issue.
Singer was always okay with limiting home grows for recreational users, but he had major concerns about medical marijuana.
If there's a kid with a seizure disorder, if there's a kid with cancer, they can't be smoking it by law, which means that it has to be distilled into, you know, a liquid tincture form. That takes a lot of plants.
But Singer came on board after the Senate made changes to the measure, doubling the medical limit to 24. He says he's now comfortable that it covers most patients. In the end, the House unanimously passed the bill, and so did the Senate. It now heads to Governor John Hickenlooper's desk, and he's indicated that he will sign the bill.
I believe that the largest amount of plants a caregiver is allowed to have anywhere in the country, I think, is 16 outside of Colorado. I think most states, it's 12.
And with the Trump administration's new attorney general, Jeff Sessions, the governor says it's especially important to rein it in.
Probably not a good time to be going out and trying to make waves around this.
The plant limit proposal is one of several marijuana measures being discussed this session, including using marijuana as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder and setting up parameters for communities that want to allow recreational pot clubs. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
To hear more of the story, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
A local environmental nonprofit and the city of Aspen have been taking steps towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Artist Sonia Heinrichsen has been bringing attention to the issue with snowshoers in the valley through an environmental art project. Claire Woodcock has the story.
Sonia Heinrichsen's vision for snow drawings began on a golf course near Anderson Ranch Arts Center, where she was in residence almost a decade ago.
At that point, it was just me playing around with snowshoes, trying to make these patterns. And I photographed them, and I thought that was quite interesting, especially with the light change. I got really dark lines and really white lines, depending where the sun and the camera was and the relationship between the two.
Heinrichsen kept returning to the project, which later inspired her to share it with other communities. She's since left her mark on the mostly frozen lakes and rivers of Colorado, the fields of upstate New York, the clearings of Vermont, and the meadows within the French Alps.
But I have to say, one place I really, really love to do these pieces is the Colorado Rockies, because they basically are embedded in the landscape. They become part of the landscape, and that is my intention.
Heinrichsen fastens her snowshoes. She's been leading volunteers and hours of exercise to make art. At one impromptu snow drawing event last month, snow was hard to come by. Heinrichsen says that weather unpredictability is the recurring obstacle she faces most with this project.
I discussed this with the venues. I asked them, what are your winters like? And I always get the same answer. Well, usually it used to always be cold from early December until March, but now we never know. I just have to live with that.
Laura Whitley is the marketing and community engagement manager for CORE. She's lived in the Valley for nearly two decades and says she knew there would be variables when determining logistics for snow drawings last month.
That included snowpack. That included weather, and that even included elk, because we're trying to find an untrammeled meadow of snow to work in. We narrowed it down to five high elevation locations, all of them above 8,000 feet. In the last week, four out of five melted out.
Tatiana Stevens runs a local blog on environmental sustainability. She's out here at McLean Flats with the other volunteers who are stomping their feet to create a big handprint in the snow. She describes the current climate conditions for this project as thin.
The snow is the canvas, so even if, like right now, the dirt is poking through, that says a lot about, you know, the conditions and how important it is with the climate to be consistent versus variable, because without the snow, this type of art isn't possible.
But she's optimistic about the outcome of this piece of art.
This will be a beautiful piece, and maybe even more profound with the dirt coming up through.
Whitley says that snow drawing is a different way of starting conversations about climate and a different way of taking action. Through optimism and creativity, Whitley hopes art will inspire the community to take bulk action on environmental preservation, an art form in and of itself.
With each snowshoe step that individuals, community participants take, they will create a collective impression. And what we're trying to do to get people to save energy is to take individual actions to create a collective impact.
Snow Drawings with Heinrichsen is the first of many events put on by CORE and the City of Aspen. This week, the two groups will officially launch the High Five Project, a year-long public awareness campaign that celebrates the elevations of five communities in the Valley.
It also stands for Take Five Actions at a Time. And then it stands for the celebratory hand slap that we all think of, because ultimately, we are all in this together.
The end goal, Whitley says, is to reduce energy consumption in the Valley, which will then reduce carbon emissions overall.
Some people say that individual action won't get it done, but what I like to think is that we won't get it done without individual action.
The High Five is all about giving people a positive experience in nature. To officially launch the project, the High Five will debut a film on snow drawings in Colorado and an energy confessional mobile art installation. Claire Woodcock, Aspen Public Radio News.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart Severy. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Zachariasen talks with a panel of local journalists about this week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.